Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
So meanwhile, what is life like in earthquake and tsunami-battered Japan? 2 months on, more than 100,000 people are still living in evacuation centers. More than 9,000 are still missing. Roland Burke is the BBC's correspondent in Japan, and he joins us now from Tokyo for a reporter's notebook. And Roland, we're trying to imagine, you know, even what it's like to be in Japan today.
I've got to say, when you go to these places on the northeast coast, it looks like not much has changed. There's debris still everywhere, wreckage in enormous piles, you know, 4 or 5 story building height of just mangled, splintered houses. You know, everything that was taken into those towns for generations was basically put through a mincer, mixed up with an awful lot of mud, and then dumped in the town. And I think the challenge for those communities up and down that coast is really dealing with that wreckage. There's 20 million tons of wreckage up there. In some towns, like Ishinomaki, the amount of wreckage and debris on the street is equivalent to the amount people would throw out in household garbage over an entire century. The problem, which they haven't really figured out, is where they're going to put it all. They're gathering it up into big piles, trying to clear the roads, but they can't live with huge piles of garbage in the middle of the city.
And what about the people? You know, we know different parts of the country have been affected differently. But we'd been hearing reports that, for instance, in Tokyo, where there wasn't, you know, that much damage, people were not using elevators and turning off the lights in department stores. How are the people responding to this?
Certainly in terms of power, there definitely is a change. You know, the neon signs Tokyo's famous for on the streets, many of those are dark. When you go into the subway stations, a lot of the escalators have been switched off. When you go into office buildings in the corridor, the lights have been switched off as well. You know, there's only one light in four that's operating. In the public loos, the heated loo seats that the Japanese love so much, they've been unplugged. That's the kind of thing people are doing. And I think they want to save electricity because they want to act in solidarity with the people of the northeast. They know there are many thousands of people who are still living 2 months on in places like school gyms, in places like school classrooms. There are people who are still sleeping on the floor in blankets, and people from around the Fukushima plant who've got no idea if they'll be able to go home, let alone when. So I think that's really infected the national mood here. People feel that they need to do their bit as well, even if they're in Tokyo and not up on the northeast coast.
And by the way, you mentioned people around the plant. We should say that the power plant operator, TEPCO, has agreed to a drastic restructuring plan in exchange for government help in paying compensation to these thousands of people who are evacuated. And as you said, we still don't know if they'll be going home. But we were talking about people, you know, exercising, I guess the phrase is self-restraint. And there's a Japanese word for that. You've and your colleagues have spoken to us about this before, this jishuku, this idea of self-restraint. For instance, we talked to Rachel Harvey about seeing undamaged vending machines filled with bottled water. This is right after the tsunami when people were desperate for food and water, but nobody would break the vending machine glass. And we hear from analyst reports that some Japanese companies are failing because of this self-restraint. Can you explain that?
Well, I think the reason why is that people feel that they shouldn't be spending money on luxuries. You're absolutely right about the fact there's no looting, by the way. In fact, hundreds of millions of yen, millions of dollars found in the wreckage in cash has been handed into the police in those cities along the northeast coast. Looting is unknown, and people find valuables in those towns and they put them in little piles by the side of the road for their rightful owners to come along and pick them up. The problem, though, I think with that solidarity and that jishuku feeling, that idea of self-restraint, is that people are stopping to do things. So you can imagine if you're a sake brewer up in the northeast, what you need is for people to have parties and to drink your sake. But if people in other parts of the country feel that somehow it's inappropriate for them to be enjoying themselves by drinking or having fun with their friends and they stop doing that, well, that's the kind of thing that puts businesses out of business. And in that sense, it has been a problem. But I think the government certainly is saying to people that this jishuku should end, and what people should be doing is perhaps buying products from the northeast. And I think gradually that's happening, but it is taking a while.
In fact, MarketWatch is watching all of this. They have a report coming out that's expected to say that more than 60 Japanese companies have failed since the quake, but only 6 were due to the physical damage of the quake. 20 failed because of this jishuku. And you spoke to a woman in a village along the coast, an 84-year-old woman, who told you it reminded her of World War II. Let's listen.
We are stronger than the young. During the Second World War, we had to escape from the bombing by running into the forests and caves. We had that experience, so we can endure no matter what happens.
I'm not sure if that's jishuku or perhaps something else, Roland Burke. What is that?
I think that's sheer grit and stoicism, which is something you see a lot in the Northeast, particularly amongst the older generation, like that woman, Ayano Goto. People are very quick to help each other and very reluctant to complain. You know, when you meet people who are in these difficult situations living in evacuation centres, they say things like, we mustn't grumble. And, you know, I feel bad because I'm better off than somebody else I know who's more unfortunate than me. I think what some people are concerned about, what psychologists are concerned about, though, is that perhaps by bottling up their feelings, the Japanese people in the Northeast, who are a pretty reserved bunch up there, it's a, you know, rural kind of area, so people are like to be self-reliant, but perhaps by bottling up their feelings and not talking about it, not feeling they can talk about it, they might be laying themselves open to possible mental health problems in the future. So psychologists have been sent up to the region, including some from Doctors Without Borders. I spoke to one psychologist about the effect on children there. Her name's Akiko Kono.
Many people have fear, especially aftershocks are still persisting here. For example, some children, they always wear the clothes or helmet, even the night time, because they think they have to evacuate immediately after they have aftershocks.
Are the Japanese, for mental health problems, mm-hmm. are the Japanese keen to seek help, or are they reluctant to come and see people like you?
Of course, usually Japanese people don't want to show their negative feelings. They want to keep their negative feelings inside, but maybe inside they are suffering a lot.
And Roland, before the break, you talked about this massive cleanup effort, tons of debris, the damage you can see. But you're also reporting on, you know, the effects of the whole disaster that you can't see. You say the Japanese people are shaky, even though it's been 2 months.
It's something, actually, this problem of people still being concerned and still being traumatized by what happened is something that's being documented across Japan. There are lots of ear, nose and throat specialists, for example, who have got people coming to them saying they're feeling phantom aftershocks. They keep feeling a slight movement in the ground, and they're wondering if there's another earthquake going to happen and it's actually them. I think once a disaster like that magnitude has happened, then it takes a while for everybody in the country to get over it.
How are schools handling this trauma?
Well, they're handling it by trying to get things back to normal. I spent a day in a school recently. It just started up in Ishinomaki, which is on the northeast coast. And for those kids, just going back at the start of the school year, it starts at about this time of year, the academic year here in Japan, just going back was a good thing, you know, because they could leave behind what they had to walk to school past, the wreckage of the tsunami and the earthquake, and get back to lessons, get back to ordinary things like maths and geometry and grammar and those kind of lessons. And so certainly I think for the teachers, they've been very concerned to get the kids back to school and give them a sense of normality starting again.
In fact, you talk about kids living in the school.
Yep, they are. This is the thing. Kids are going back to classrooms, but school, it's some normality, but nothing's going to be normal in these places for a long, long time. Pretty much every school is still being used as an evacuation centre as well, because, you know, homes are still destroyed and those are the strong buildings, so that's where people have been moved into. The school I was in had 200 people living in the classrooms up on the third floor, and in fact some of them were pupils at the school. They just moved in there with their parents. I met a couple of them, Hibiki, he's 11, and Aina, who's 10, and they're living in what used to be the classroom for grade 6.
What's it like living here?
It's good that class is close by, but home, of course, would be better.
When the school was closed, I couldn't play with my friends, so I am happy that it has started again.
This gives us some sense of normalcy, even if in some cases they're living in their schools. The BBC's Roland Burke has opened his reporter's notebook for us as he continues to report from Japan in the aftermath of the earthquake and tsunami. Roland, just the overall sense, what do people need now? Do people in the shelters have enough food? Do they have enough clean water and sanitation? Are they able to participate in the culture? I mean, it may seem silly, but can they watch television? You know, what's your sense of what people really need?
I think what people need is to get back to, or to have some idea of when life as it is for them now in those evacuation centres is going to end, when they're going to get back to some kind of normality. And I think when they go down to the towns where they once lived and look, and they look around and they see, in a sense, how much has changed, because it's such a big job, but in relation to the overall job of clearing up and rebuilding, what a very long way there is to go. I think that is what, when you talk to people, they say gets them down. Some people are already doing things about that themselves. Even if they've been moved to towns a long way away from where they originally came from, you know, kids have been enrolled in schools, people are going out and getting jobs because they have to, and people are starting to move out of evacuation centres into flats. So for some people, they won't ever go back to those towns along the coast. But I think it's the lack of an end in sight that is so concerning for people, and particularly for those people around the nuclear power plant, of course. For them, it's even worse.
Well, and speaking of the lack of an end, the 9,000 people missing, is the thinking that they will be found in the debris, or, as we've been hearing, that they've been swept out to sea, which we understand for the Japanese is very traumatizing. There's a sense that they'll be haunted by those people. In fact, we heard in one report that someone felt they couldn't even go in the water until bodies were recovered.
I think the likelihood is that many of those people won't be recovered, because they will have been sucked out to sea by the tsunami when the waters receded with lots of force on the northeast coast. What there isn't, though, is any sense that the process of looking for them is going to stop. And I met a whole company of soldiers, hundreds of soldiers in Ishinomaki, who were going through. They had kind of metal sticks with spikes on the end, and they were using that to go through the wreckage and to turn things over and keep looking for bodies, and asked them if they'd found any recently. And they said for the previous few days they hadn't found any at all, but they weren't going to stop until the local authorities, you know, the mayor and the council in that town, said to them, right, that's it, give up, we've had enough, stop, you don't have to look anymore. They felt it was their duty to keep going and to keep looking for people, even if they didn't think there was much hope of them finding any of them.
Yeah. Roland, I'm assuming you have so many mental snapshots, but is there one image that stays with you, one story you'd want to share?
I think what's been most striking on the northeast coast is the boats and the ships, because lots of vessels were swept inland and ended up on top of buildings and in the middle of smashed villages. And in a way, they're symbolic of the problem that Japan's got, because they're getting rid of, particularly the big steel boats, big steel ships, is such an immense problem. They're stuck inland and they can't be taken back to the sea. They're going to have to be broken up where they are, but that's a huge job, and there isn't really even the expertise to do that here. Those striking images of those boats and those ships so far from the sea, and the prospect that they're going to be there for a long time, I think that's something that, you know, when you've seen a boat, a massive boat on top of a three-story building, it's something you don't forget.
The BBC's Roland Burke from Tokyo. Roland, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you very much indeed.